In the wilds of Canada.
She sticks her thumb out and then she's never heard again.
There's a lonely highway.
Something went very wrong that night.
Daughters are going missing. And the forest hides a mystery.
A serial killer or a group of killers.
What kind of monster is driving the Highway of Tears?
It's like some evil coming over you and you can't stop till it's done.
I'm M. William Phelps, investigative journalist, and I have an obsession. Serial killer cold cases.
Now, nearly 10 years later, investigators say they still need the public's help.
For me, it's personal. My sister-in-law was murdered, and her killer has never been caught. These killers are still out there. Their victims deserve justice. And just one new clue could make all the difference. I don't have a badge, but I do have something the cops don't have. Someone who understands the dark mind of a murderer.
As I started killing again and again, I saw it as a purpose.
Because he is one. This is British Columbia, the raw Canadian wilderness, 500 miles north of the U.S. border. Fresh air, green meadows, clear streams. Up here, I feel far from the troubles and dangers of the big city. But it's a false sense of security. Because this highway I'm walking on has a nickname. The maps call it Highway 16. The locals call it the Highway of Tears. When night falls out here, it's not the bears you have to watch out for. It's the serial killers. So I'm here in British Columbia, along the Highway of Tears, and I look around me and this beautiful river, steelhead and salmon fishing going on right in back of me. My God, do I wish I was here to fish, but I'm not. I'm here to look into the disappearance of many young girls and the murder and sexual assault of many more. So in one respect, you have paradise over my shoulder. But you know what? When I look at that highway, I see blood. I see tears, and I see darkness.
There was a string of unsolved killings. At least five of those victims are on the new police list.
From 1969 to 2006, 18 young women have officially gone missing or been murdered in this region. The locals say that number could be as high as 30. We're talking attractive young women, mostly teenagers and mostly hitchhikers. The bodies that have been found were dumped not far from the highway. All the cases are unsolved. Is this the work of one serial killer? Or is it something even more frightening? Is this lonely wilderness the hunting ground for a team of serial killers?
The Highway of Tears, Matthew, is a serial killer's dream.
And how does that course?
Criminal profiler John Kelly knows the mind of a serial killer better than anyone I know. What we have out there, Kelly, is a stretch of highway about 900 miles long. The question is it a serial? Is it a team of serials? Is it a bunch of one-offs?
Could be all the above. I mean, you have a lot of dead women. over a long time span. I think what you're looking at is multiple serial killers. It's hard for me to believe that it's only one serial killer. Is that possible? Yes. Is it probable over such a large time span? No.
When John Kelly and I want to get inside the skin of the serial killer we're chasing, we go straight to the source, an actual serial killer. Codename Raven. He's been calling me from prison for over a year now.
We've got what? Anywhere from 18 to 40, 45 murders here over the span of 40 years, 900 miles. You think this is one guy?
Nice of Raven to say that. Shame the fathers, husbands, and boyfriends of his victims didn't get the same heads up.
If you just take a look at all those photos on the board. So those girls are staring at us.
Yeah.
The two of us.
Yeah, yeah. They're looking, their eyes are.
They're saying, please help us. I mean, that's the vibe, the feeling I'm getting.
You and I both know. You know, the good news is you possibly have a couple of serial killers. The bad news is you have 18 separate killers who could become serial killers.
One, two, three serial killers? The Canadian Mounted Police proudly say they always get their man. But this is the ultimate test of that promise.
My task force is looking at 18 victims, 13 murdered, and 5 missing.
For Staff Sergeant Wayne Cleary, the Highway of Tears case is all-consuming. He's got 75 people working it day and night.
The investigation's been going on now for about 5 years. To get this thing started, we had over 700 banker boxes of information relating to those 18 investigations alone.
And solving these kinds of cases is about as hard as it gets.
Well, I would say it would be a stranger-to-stranger attack, which are the toughest cases to solve. Generally, there's no witnesses involved other than the perpetrator, so they're very, very difficult.
Now, the key phrase there is stranger-to-stranger attack. That's the bread and butter of the serial killer. You don't know him, and he doesn't know you.
We're very much alive to the fact that there could be connections. We're very much alive to the potential of a serial killer or a group of killers. I don't believe there's one serial killer, but until we actually can come out and say definitively, we're just keep our minds open to any possibility.
Are these killers here or this killer smart or just lucky?
Perhaps a combination of both. I think they're private about what they've done, and perhaps that's what's protected them.
And the other thing that's protecting these killers? The wilderness. 5 of these girls have never been found. You don't have to drive too far on the Highway of Tears before you start to feel lonely.
We're in the middle of nowhere out here. I haven't seen a gas station in miles. I'm driving along this barren stretch of the road right now. Looking for a guy like this? It's like seeing a school of salmon running up the river and try to pick one of them out. They all look the same. This guy looks like anybody driving down this road.
But this place is more than wilderness. There are people living here, tight-knit communities, and they're hurting. It's their daughters who are gone, and they've been dodging serial killers all their lives. Wednesday, September 21st, 2005. It's just another day on Canada's notorious Highway of Tears. And another young woman is out hitchhiking, alone. Tamara Chipman is 22. She has a young son at home, and she's trying to get back there.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you going through Terrace?
Yeah, jump in.
But after heading out to the highway, no one sees her again. No body is ever found. Nothing.
She was spunky as a child. She was a little spoiled. She was funny. She was quite the character growing up as a child.
Tamara's aunt, Gladys Radick, is still waiting for her to come home.
If she's alive, we want to bring her home. If she's on the other side, we still want to bring her home. One way or the other. It's the not knowing that's killing us. It's got a big hole in all of our hearts. Because when I see her little guy now, he is a spitting image of her. And it's just heartbreaking. At the same time, you can see her little character in him, and he's just an awesome little guy.
Most of the missing and the dead are what Canadians call First Nations people. They are the original locals of these streams and mountains. Gladys Radick wanted the First Nations victims to have a voice, so she took to the road herself, walking the Highway of Tears and then across Canada.
During the course of the long investigation, Native women marched through the streets to keep up pressure on police. They always felt the crimes were connected. Now there's apparently mounting evidence they may be right.
I carry a heavy load. My heart is heavy. I feel like crying a lot of times. But I also carry the message that they want. They've been silenced for so many years and decades.
While the official list of dead and missing for the Highway of Tears is 18, Gladys Radick says it's much higher, could be up to 43. And on her walks across the whole of Canada, she hears of many more.
Our stats that we got from family members while we were walking are 4,200 missing and murdered women across Canada. And about 80% of those are First Nations. So if you start putting the statistics together and you figure even if 3,000 of those women were First Nations, the average First Nations woman will have average 5 children in a lifetime. So that means we're missing out on 15,000 children for our future generations.
Gladys knows what it's like to face a serial killer. She escaped the clutches of one of Canada's worst, Clifford Olson.
This was back in the 70s in Vancouver. I had just missed my bus. I got off work late and started hitchhiking. And I was actually picked up by Clifford Olson.
Hi.
Hey, where you headed?
I'm headed for the US.
Jump in.
I was pretty young then. I was also pretty small for my age at that time. Clifford Olson liked children, and he wasn't fussy whether it was boy or girl.
Olson killed 11 young people in BC's Lower Mainland. He raped some first and strangled or bludgeoned most to death.
On this night, Gladys could have joined that grim list.
I was in the front seat of his car, and At that time, he had one of those cars where the automatic locks had come in, and I couldn't find the button. Kept on reaching, and I kept on reaching. While he was trying to pull at me, he had my hair. I turned around and I found the button, and I just managed to grab the knob of that little button. I opened the door and fell out. And I was saved by an elder couple that had heard me screaming from their house.
Gladys was lucky. Up on the Highway of Tears, no one can hear you scream.
It does scare me when a young girl is going home to see her parents. There's no buses. She doesn't have money for a taxi. She has her whole life ahead of her. She sticks her thumb out on the freeway, and then she's never heard again. That scares me in any community.
Most of these victims were last seen hitchhiking before they disappeared. And yeah, we all know that's dangerous. But up here, things are different. People don't have a lot of cash. They don't have cars, especially young people. And there's no alternative. There's no bus, no subway. There's just the thumb.
I used to hitchhike up there quite regularly. That's where my family is. And it is of the norm because virtually public transportation is only available once a day. That's for over 700 kilometers.
The warning's right there. Girls, don't hitchhike. And yet they still do it. This billboard is what? 20 feet from Highway 16. There's a killer on the loose. Says it right there. But they still do it. It's out of necessity that they do it. And you know what? No one believes they're going to be killed by a serial killer. But serial killers love hitchhikers. Raven loved hitchhikers. Were your victims convenient?
My victims came along when they came along. And a thing called karma was fate. I didn't put them there. And they didn't put me there. It just fucking didn't happen. People that hit me.
Well, there's another thing you discover when you talk to a serial killer. According to them, it's often the victim's fault. Just like it's the baby zebra's fault for walking in front of a lion. So now I'm thinking, if hitchhiking is dangerous, if the highway is dangerous, then the next question is, who uses that highway? So when I think of a vocation, a job for this guy, one thing obviously comes to mind, a trucker. Is that what we're looking at?
Well, I'm going to tell you, when I'm looking at this highway of tears, I mean, trucker really comes into my mind because, you know, that's somebody that's driving up and down all the time and has better odds of seeing a victim of opportunity.
You know, I stood on that highway. I watched people stop and pick hitchhikers up myself. So it's a common thing for anybody to pick up a hitchhiker, not just truckers.
Whatever they're doing in the area, if they have the opportunity to drive the road, they have the opportunity to see the hitchhikers. streets. You know how these guys are. I mean, they're constantly driving.
Constantly driving. You've got that right, Kelly. There's mile after mile to soak up out here on Highway 16. Mile after mile after mile.
Somebody told me while I was here, the cases don't go cold. They only go cold if you stop investigating. These cases here are hot. And this killer is out here.
But this guy won't pick up just anybody. Like any animal out hunting, the conditions have to be just right before he takes the risk of striking his prey.
So he's hunting, and he may pass five hitchhikers before he comes to the perfect victim.
He's gonna come to the victim that he feels the safest with.
Ah.
And he may pass 8, 9 victims, but if he thinks he's gonna be seen, that may distract him from his prey.
Ah.
He may move away from his prey if he believes that somebody has him in their sights. He does not want to be connected. And obviously, this killer or these killers over the years have been pretty successful in staying out of view.
I can only imagine being a young girl on this road in the middle of the night. It's got to be as dark as the bottom of the ocean. Like a cave. I'd take a ride from anybody. Those headlights pulling over, pulling past me, the sound of that car hitting the gravel, someone yelling, "Hey, come on in, I'll give you a ride." That's a sense of comfort. That's the sound of safety. The last thing that I'm thinking about is that ride picking me up is my last ride.
And me, I've got a few more stops to make on this highway. We've got 18 missing over a 37-year span. I need to narrow that down into clusters. There's a small town up here that's lost some of its children. I've got a feeling some answers lie there. The small town of Smithers sits almost in the middle of the Highway of Tears. Only 5,500 people live here. It's a tiny dot surrounded by the Canadian wilderness. And as the bitter winter thaws up here each year, there's a local lady who starts to worry.
I always warn everyone, please don't be alone tonight. Be with somebody. I'm scared every summer someone will be missing.
In the summer of 1995, Matilda Wilson took a phone call, the call no parent should ever have to receive.
They said that we'd like you to identify the clothing that we found, and we think it's your daughter's. And I knew right away when I went in there, they had all her clothes hanging up, and it was all her clothes.
10 months earlier, Matilda's 16-year-old daughter, Ramona, had gone missing.
And I was just cleaning up in the kitchen, and she was just going down the stairs. "Mom, I'll see you later." "Okay," I said, "take care." And that was it.
Ramona planned to join some friends at a party just down the highway. The only way to get there was to hitch a ride.
She was going to her friends again because they had stayed over the weekend before, so she was going to go at their place. And she always came back. And something went very wrong that night.
This is the area right here where Ramona Wilson's body was discovered. In the bush, as they would say out here. It's off a side road, about a half a mile from the highway. For 10 months, Ramona Wilson's body, this young girl, sexually assaulted, murdered violently, she just lies there in the bush, waiting to be found. I just can't imagine the pain that this family went through, and their child was just miles down the road, and her body frozen in the snow. It was only luck that uncovered her resting place. When summer came round again, a couple of guys were deep in the forest in their 4x4. They were well off the beaten track when their day turned to horror. Ramona's body wasn't easy to find.
The location where she was found, it's quite a ways from the highway. Maybe this guy really knows these trails because he went a long ways off the trail to carry the body, to carry her that far out into the bush. Seems like the killer knew where to go.
So did Ramona's killer know that spot? Raven has been talking to me a lot about dump sites. When he was out killing, they were on his mind a lot.
You know, when I'm talking about the dump site now, for a lot of these victims, it was fairly close to the road. What does that tell us about him?
Well, if they're close to the road, the guy's traveled. That's the new one place, and he doesn't know the area. If it's a mile in, that's kind of like telling there's a local guy.
It's one way to separate these killers. A local up here would know a lot of places to hide a body. That may explain the girls that have never been found.
It's very probable that we have multiple serials in these cases. One who feels that he might be connected to the victim through DNA if the victim's found or because he's been seen with the victim. So he wants the victim out of sight, out of mind. No body, no DNA, no crime.
So Ramona Wilson's killer may have known the area. He tried hard to hide her body. He was scared she might be connected to him.
The other predator, the other serial killer, really doesn't care because he feels nobody saw him. He feels he can't be connected to the victim. So it's just, you know, kill them, dump and run.
Yeah, I look around here. I look up the roads, horse farms, cow farms, grizzly bears in the woods right behind me. It's the ideal place for a serial killer, really, to just fade into the background. Come out at night and kill on the highway, and then fade away. And what he leaves behind, in most cases, are bodies. I've got a question for John Kelly. Just what do these killers feel once they dump that body?
Serial killers, when they dispose of a victim, it's like they're disposing of rubbish or garbage or however you want to look at it. He's objectified them. They were something that he used for his pleasure, and now he's done with them, so they're dispensable. He's throwing them away alongside the road as a piece of trash.
But Kelly, after that point, how does he feel? What is he thinking when he walks away from that trash?
When a serial killer finally disposes of a body, he feels a relief. He feels no remorse. He feels no guilt. He feels happy. He feels that he's had power and control, and he's at the top of his game. He's gratified. He feels nothing for the victim.
This Highway of Tears, it has a long history. A cluster of cases date back to the early 70s, and those cases have all the hallmarks of a dump-and-run killer. The Mounties that worked those murders, they're still around. And they don't forget these girls, just like their families don't forget. There's one of them I want to meet. November 1973. A bitter winter is setting in on the province of British Columbia, Canada.
A young woman, naked in the water. No sign of life. She was sexually assaulted, strangled, and drowned.
The young woman was 19-year-old Pamela Darlington. Investigating her case, an old-time Mountie named Fred Bodnarook.
There she was, just hitchhiking a few hours earlier, and there she is. She's finished. Her life's done. Young, beautiful, all that.
These were the early cases of what would become the Highway of Tears murders.
Most of them were young females found murdered on roadsides. Investigation would show that they were hitchhikers.
Hello?
Hi.
Were they all sexually assaulted?
As far as we could tell. Some of the bodies were practically destroyed. The circumstantial evidence showed that they accepted rides and in all likelihood were raped.
Pamela Darlington was part of a cluster of murders around the town of Kamloops. Gloria Moody, 1969. Gail Ways, 1973. Colleen McMillan, 1974. Fred Bodnarook has watched a killing continue for decades. What does he think? For a start, he agrees with John Kelly's profile. This killer's job makes him mobile.
If you look at the region up there, it's just miles of highways and bush. So when you get to a community, it's just a stop along the way because that is long, long mileage up there. So we often suspected that the murderer could be a truck driver, a traveling man.
And then Fred throws out something in his quiet Canadian way that stops me in my tracks.
You know, there are copycats too.
Copycats?
You may have a couple
serial killers within range of one another, and they're almost competing. One will excite him into action by the fact that somebody else has just killed similarly to his style. But my feeling is that there may be more than one person on the Highway of Tears.
What's worse than multiple serial killers? Having them feed off each other's crimes. I wonder what Raven thinks about that.
Someone is having a boring constant. He picks up the newspaper and reads about this murder that happened. And it has a lot of similarities to what he has done. I'm sure that he may very well get excited about what has been done. That might even spur him on to think maybe I should go out and do this again. And he may want to go out there and do one better.
Fred Bodnaruk and I have something in common. He also had a serial killer he would speak to, one he liked as a suspect in these murders.
I spent a lot of time talking to him just as we sit here, and I'd say, what drove you? How did you feel that very day? What happened? He said, well, it was a nice day, and he said, I just felt that I had to have excitement and so on. So I got in my car and I started to drive up and down the streets to see who I could find. And then I saw this one and I got her in the car, and of course the rest happened.
That killer was convicted of three other murders elsewhere in Canada. Eventually, he was ruled out as being involved in the Highway of Tears. But Fred won't forget his words.
He did say that he wasn't satisfied until he was certain his victim was murdered. Even he said, it's like some evil coming over you and you can't stop till it's done.
Is that how a killer on the Highway of Tears feels? Overcome by evil? Cruising the highway, just waiting for a victim to stick out her thumb and step into his trap? What kind of guy would do that? I'm about to find out. The Highway of Tears, a case that spans over 40 years. 18 young women, dead or missing across the remote north of British Columbia, Canada.
Route 16, often called the Highway of Tears, once again at the center of a criminal investigation.
It's one of the great mysteries of Canadian crime. But for the people who live in the middle of it, life goes on. It has to.
The entire time I've been here, I've felt nothing but safe, greeted with warmth. And the people here, I've talked to them, and they feel safe, too. I think the only people who are unsafe are young women walking on Highway 16 at night. I think if you do that, I think you may end up dead.
So what do we have in this case? Not much. Little evidence and a few eyewitnesses. But it has to be more than one killer. One a local, trying to cover his tracks. And the other, a guy on the move, a traveling worker. He kills, he dumps, he runs. They both have problems with women, no doubt. They both have to be stopped. And as each year goes by after a murder, a funny thing is happening. People's memories are fading. Some eyewitnesses may not be around anymore, but technology is improving, and DNA holds the key.
Over the years, what our forensic labs can do for us have improved dramatically. So we've been able to get some help that way, and we do have some DNA evidence that we have to work with.
Today's technology can get information out of tinier and tinier samples.
For example, 5 years ago, we would submit a shirt of a young girl or a pair of pants, and they identified DNA on there, but we were told that it's not enough. We don't have the technology. But we would wait, and we would submit it 5 years later, and the technology has increased so much, we get DNA hits. And when that happens, that's high fives in the office, especially on these old files.
And there's still more evidence sealed in Ziploc bags, just waiting for the next step forward in the lab. Who knows what secrets those small shreds of DNA may hold? In September 2012, proof that from the depths of time, for cases 40 years old, answers can be found.
We are here today to announce a significant development.
The break was an almost 30-year-old DNA sample taken from the body of 16-year-old Colleen McMillan.
In 1974, Colleen McMillan left home to hitchhike to a friend's house nearby. Her body was later found dumped off a logging road. Crime scene evidence containing traces of the killer's DNA was kept for over 30 years. Then, as technology improved, the DNA went back to the lab.
A DNA profile of an unknown male was identified from Colleen's case.
The DNA profile went to Interpol, and they came up with a match. Bobby Jack Fowler, an American with a rap sheet a mile long. Attempted murder, kidnapping, sexual assault, arson. He fits the profile of our dump-and-run killer. He's a drifter who'd been working near Colleen McMillan's home back in 1974.
He worked odd jobs in areas like roofing and general labor. He frequented bars and restaurants and was violent towards men and women and picked up hitchhikers.
And Bobby Jack Fowler moved around a lot. He's also the prime suspect in another case I've been investigating.
So it was a black van.
Two double murders in the coastal city of Newport, Oregon. Just like on the Highway of Tears, teenage girls were hitchhiking. Picked up, murdered, and hastily dumped in the forest.
Fowler is responsible for the murder of 16-year-old Colleen McMillan.
He's also a person of interest in the murders of Pamela Darlington and Gail Ways. But he has been ruled out for 8 of the 18 murders. And he won't kill again. Bobby Fowler died in prison in Oregon in 2006. So we've got answers on some of the early cases and proof that more than one person has a taste for killing on the Highway of Tears.
I gotta hand it to Kelly. He had this guy pegged. As a serial killer, Bobby Jack Fowler was an opportunist. He wasn't smart or sophisticated. He took chances when they came up, and then he got the hell out of Dodge. That's what he did. For 40 years. And if he isn't responsible for those other murders, that means there's another serial killer out there, trolling the Highway of Tears. And that's the kind of stuff that keeps this guy up at night. And this is where law enforcement can hand a part of this case back to the public.
The general public can think back to those cities, think back to those times. Who did they associate with if they were there? And think about some things that didn't sit well with them that they think the police should know about. What's going to take to solve the cases now is people coming forward and telling us what they know.
Somebody knows something.
It's always been that way, and it'll always be that way.
Just what is it going to take to flush another killer out?
A mistake. Or somebody holding back information that knows. It could be a girlfriend. It could be a relationship will go sour and she'll inform.
So, is he still out there?
I fear so, yes.
They're still out there. Two, maybe more killers on that highway. Signs will go up. Mothers will beg their daughters not to hitchhike. But when there's no other way to get around, teenage girls aren't always going to do what they're told. They'll go back to that highway and stick out that thumb. And behind the wheel, a murderer will be smiling.
When she was 12 years old, her and I, one time we were baking cookies for Christmas. And she was saying, "Mom, you know what? I really want to be a psychologist when I grow up. I really want to help a lot of people out. You know what? I even listened to some of the kids because they got so many problems and I feel so bad for them and I want to help everybody."
All little Ramona Wilson wanted to do was help people.
It's very difficult. Especially on Christmas or any holidays and her birthday, I sit here and cry.
A serial killer. He extinguishes the light of life and he spreads darkness everywhere. To him, our children are garbage. And that can't be. That can't be. People gotta come forward. People got to talk about what they know, even if it's about their next-door neighbor. Because you don't know your next-door neighbor. He could be that monster. He could be that guy.
People know something out there, and they suspect, but they won't come forward. And I would like them to throw their fear aside or their concern and just go out there and say, I suspect so-and-so, or you should look at so-and-so. And many times, they're right.